This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks so much for joining a national debate. We're entertaining questions about Syria. Why does Syria matter? How could a U.S. military strike change things in Syria, in the Middle East? Those questions came up at hearings yesterday in the Senate. They're continuing to come up on Capitol Hill. This hour, we'll look at some of those questions from lawmakers, from constituents, and from people in the region. What questions do you want asked by your lawmaker, asked of your president, about a possible U.S. strike at Syria? We'd love your questions. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Contact us at facebook.com/thetakeaway or go to thetakeaway.org. People around the world have questions for the Obama administration about what happens next. Joining us now is Ambassador Itamar Rabinovich, was the Israeli ambassador to the United States from 1993 to 1996, chief negotiator with Syria back in the 90s. He joins us from Tel Aviv. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you.
What question do you have of the Obama administration about this possible Syrian strike and your colleagues in Israel?
My question is, how are you taking advantage of this hiatus, not just to garner support in Congress for the vote, but to put together a better concept of what it is that you want to accomplish by the strike, and how do you fit it into a larger strategy?
Do you have suspicion that the U.S. was inclined to act without thinking strategically about all of the options and the outcomes possible in Syria?
I think that at the time that the president made the decision to delay and to go to Congress, he was about to make a limited strike, sort of going through the motions strike, and I think that he may have figured out that this would be a mistake, that just firing 20, 30 or Tomahawk missiles in probably abandoned buildings or installations, and then having Bashar al-Assad come out of the building smiling and moving on would have been a mistake.
You know, that question, precisely that question, was asked by Republican Senator James Risch of Idaho, of Secretary of State John Kerry. He also asked some questions about the general stability in the region. Kerry had his answer for Senator Risch, but I'd like to put the question directly to you. Listen to Senator James Risch of Idaho here.
What happens if this thing gets away from us? I mean, what happens? You've been on the border between Israel and Lebanon, as I have. And since the last war, I mean, the Hezbollah has really beefed that up. What happens if they get into it with Israel? What's our response to that going to be?
That question there, of course, to Secretary of State John Kerry. But what do you think the likelihood is of things getting out of hand, as Senator Risch put it there, Ambassador Rabinovich?
Not specifically by Hezbollah along the Israeli-Lebanese border, because this would mean another major war between Israel and Hezbollah, terrible destruction in both countries, involving Iran. Iran itself is not interested in such a general war because it is afraid that it would lead to an attack on its own nuclear installations. So there can be complications and things can get out of hand, but not specifically in this context. You know, Syria has other borders with Turkey and with Jordan. It's very closely involved with what goes on in Lebanon and, of course, Iraq. And things could get out of hand in several directions. But let's put it this way. If the United States doesn't act, things will certainly get out of hand.
We're talking with Ambassador Itamar Rabinovich, the Israeli ambassador to the United States from 1993 to 1996. I want your reaction to this comment from Secretary of State John Kerry, which I'm sure you heard yesterday, about a contact he had with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. Listen.
Well, I talked with Prime Minister Netanyahu just yesterday, and he made it pretty clear to me that Israel feels very confident about Israel's ability to be able to deal, as they have previously, with a miscalculation by Assad, and the rest of the community, the Turks, the Jordanians, the Emiratis, the Saudis, the Qataris, the United States, France, others, all have a capacity.
Ambassador Rabinovich, your reaction, and do you go along with the Kerry's suggestion that there's some sort of coalition to respond to a miscalculation by Assad that would include the Qataris, the Saudis, and the Israelis?
Yeah, I fully endorse the statement in its two parts. One is Israel is confident, and Israel really is not marginal, but it's not the central issue. It's a side issue in what is a major regional and international issue. Now, there is no formal military coalition, but there is a large group of countries in the region and international actors who have the same view, and the view is that there has to be an end to this war, and that the end includes a change of regime.
All right, Ambassador, does that explain why there's such a quiet response by the Israelis, which you've even referred to in some press reports, to this contemplated U.S. action?
No, you know, Israel is definitely well-equipped, quite a strong military force. The Syrian army is in very bad repair after 2.5 years of civil war. The Syrians know that, or Assad knows that a major attack on Israel would lead to the destruction of his army and therefore to the fall of the regime. But with one caveat, you know, if he were such a rational actor, he would not have used chemical weapons when the UN inspectors were around.
Ambassador Itamar Rabinovich, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Ambassador Itamar Rabinovich was Israeli ambassador to the United States from 1993 to 1996. He spoke to us from Tel Aviv. Questions from Israel, questions closer to home. Why intervene in Syria at all?
Hi, this is DJ calling from St. Paul, Minnesota. And my take is that America should butt out other people's business. Usually are the people that cause these different actions to go on in different countries, and then they go in and cause even more problems. They should take care of home first.
Thanks to our listener, Vijay, there in St. Paul, Minnesota. In the 8th Congressional District of Minnesota, up in Duluth, Rick Nolan, the Democratic congressman, joins us. Congressman Nolan, welcome.
Hi, John.
It's great to talk to you. What question do you have of the administration, of the Secretary of State, of anyone who's putting forth this policy and contemplating an intervention in Syria?
Well, my questions are about both the unknown and the known, and the fact that the administration is not talking about a lot of things. They're talking about the fact that there's been a horrific gas attack and something needs to be done, and nothing could be further from the truth. But, you know, in the areas of unknown, we don't know what this strike is going to look like, how intensive or lack of intensity is going to be there. As the ambassador Rabinovich just said, you know, for the U.S. to just strike and walk away would be a mistake. We know there will be some kind of a response, but we don't know exactly what it'll be. We've looked at all the evidence that would strongly suggest that Assad was responsible for the gas attacks, but we've ignored the possibilities here of an accidental attack or a clever, conniving arrangement of the attack by al-Qaeda, who would stand to benefit the most from this. And there's no talk about the known facts. This is going to cost us hundreds of millions of dollars in the attack. You know, hundreds and perhaps more people will be killed in our attack. Clearly, it risks a wider war. And I hear, you know, all this business about no boots on the ground, as though nobody learned anything from the lessons of Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan. I remember the President of the United States in Vietnam saying we ought not to send American boys to fight an Asian boys' war. But the fact is, once you launch a military attack against another country, and I know the administration doesn't like to call it that, but anybody who knows anything about an act of war know that if you launch a massive military strike against another country, that's an act of war. And inevitably, you know, that elicits some kind of a response, which results in changing circumstances. And then, you know, guess who it is that wants to send boots in the ground? You know, the very same people who said there would be no boots on the ground. The fact is, you know, these wars of choice and this nation building abroad is bankrupting this country. It's creating ill will all over the world. I've lived and worked in the Middle East, and I've studied the language and the culture, and I've done business there. I know the people. And these wars of choice and this so-called nation building is causing more harm and more damage than it is good.
Oh,
and there is an international crimp. One last thing.
Go ahead.
We do need to respond to to this whole matter. And there's a thing called the International Criminal Courts where leaders are brought to task for crimes against humanity. And that's exactly what this is. And we need to know who did it, and we need to prosecute them. We do not need to start another war in the Middle East.
All right. Well, then my question to you is, based on that last comment, I'm wondering if you would agree or disagree with this listener who's in Minnesota, but a little farther south of your district. Listen.
This is Kelly Jones calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota, calling to say that I believe the president should wait until the UN weighs in. But I also believe that intervention is necessary, not because of the kinds of weapons that people are being killed with, but because it's the right thing to do. Do we really care whether you get killed by a traditional weapon or by a chemical weapon? As long as there's a need for intervention, then we should go in on that basis.
Congressman Nolan, Kelly says there's a moral issue here. What do you think?
Well, I agree of much of what Kelly Jones has said, except for her conclusion that we have to get involved in that war. You know, in Syria in particular, you know, they won their independence from the French back in the late 1940s. Since that time, they've literally had dozens of governments. They have had instances where they killed massive numbers of their people. What we're witnessing here is a century-old conflict between Sunnis and Shiites and thugs struggling for control and for power. And to involve ourselves in those conflicts where we have no friends. Make no mistake about it. The rebels in Syria are dominated by al-Nusra. They are al-Qaeda. They're leading because they had 10 years of live combat training and experience fighting us. And Assad and Hezbollah are no friends of ours.
So in this vote, you would vote against a resolution at this point? There is a resolution already working its way through Congress.
Yeah, I can't talk about all the classified information I've seen, but I've sat through about 4 hours of briefings. I went into the intelligence room and I read through all the classified documents, and I have seen nothing in there that persuades me that anything good could be accomplished with a military strike. On the contrary, it's going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars we can ill afford. It's going to kill a lot of people. There is a way to deal with this. It's called the International Criminal Courts.
All right. To Congressman Rick Nolan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Congressman Rick Nolan is a Democratic congressman representing Minnesota's 8th District in the Duluth area in the north. As Congress debates intervention in Syria, we want to hear from you.
Andrew from Portland. I think we should be involved in Syria if we have to be in a limited way, because I'm tired of seeing my friends going overseas to try to solve other people's problems.
What are the limits? What are your questions about a possible intervention by the U.S. in Syria? This is The Takeaway. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Last week's announced settlement by the NFL was a labor story, a business story, and a medical story. The entertainment of pro football comes at a huge cost. A head trauma for players is a lifelong debilitating reality. The greater than even chance that someone will get a concussion in an NFL game is something the NFL now accepts as partly its responsibility. The nearly $10 billion a year league has agreed to pay out $765 million to compensate injured players and to prevent future injuries. Steve Fainaro is a senior writer for ESPN. The settlement came just as he and his brother and a team of journalists and filmmakers were finishing the forthcoming book, League of Denial, and a frontline documentary on NFL head injuries. The documentary, produced by our partners WGBH, airs October 8th. Fainaro says the settlement, while imperfect, represents an extreme turnaround for the league.
When you look at it just from the sort of historical perspective, I mean, the NFL went from denying that there was such a thing, there was a connection between football and brain damage. They continued to deny it and continued to deny it all the way up until 2010 when they were now being pressured by Congress. They've gone from there to now doling out $750 million to treat players for exactly these issues. And so, yes, I would agree that in many ways it is a vindication for, you know, not just the journalists who have been reporting on it, but particularly the players who have been, you know, fighting this battle for years now.
Does this seem to be genuine compassion in your view, or is it a corporate position that basically says, oh, my gosh, we forgot the players are actually our entertainers. We have to take care of them?
I think the reality is that they were brought to this point, the point of a legal bayonet. They did not begin to take action on this issue until they were embarrassed before Congress, and then they were sued by nearly one-third of all living players. So I think people can draw conclusions from that. I do think that the new commissioner, or he's not so new anymore, Roger Goodell, who inherited this issue, has been a lot more proactive around that. And the NFL is certainly doing a lot more now in terms of putting money toward research, changing the rules, trying to assure players that they are trying to do the right thing. I think there's still a huge amount of skepticism among the community of retired players about the NFL's intentions. And frankly, I'm not sure that the settlement has mollified that. And in some ways, I think it's actually accentuated it.
Are you surprised by how much journalists have really driven the league to actually come to this position? We're talking about ESPN here. We're talking about you. We're talking about HBO. We're talking about a lot of journalists who've been on this for a long time.
This issue, the issue of football players and head injuries, you know, particularly with ESPN, which has a contract with the NFL, has been going on since 1994. I mean, ESPN has been at the forefront in covering this issue. I'm not surprised by that at all. I guess what I'm surprised by is that I really do think it gained a lot of traction over the last several years, and it really began to resonate. And then, of course, you know, the New York Times got involved in the issue in a very big way. And when the Times started putting the story on the front page, that really, really resonated. And I think it really gave the issue a lot of traction.
Although, how do you respond to the Times story, which suggests that NFL pressure is behind the change in your relationship with ESPN on this documentary project?
Any journalist would be disappointed by that, the insinuation that some sort of outside pressure may have been involved in the dissolution of a partnership that was, by all accounts, wildly successful. At the same time, you know, I think for us, the question has been, is this going to affect our journalism in any way, and especially our journalism at ESPN? And I think that what we've been told and what we've concluded is that it's not going to affect it one iota.
Do you think it's fun to be a football player? And if so, do the entertainment conglomerates that gain so much from them really do them justice in the end?
For these players, they're competing at the highest level of their sport and their profession. At the same time, I think that what we discovered while we were reporting on the book and the film was the incredible toll that being an NFL player takes on one's body and, as is being discovered, on your mind. I mean, it is an incredibly violent sport in a way that is not conveyed in any real way through television, that the violence that occurs is in many ways sanitized by television in the same way that I think, in a similar way to the way combat and war movies sanitize violence. It's just impossible to replicate the incredible amount of violence that's occurring on the field. And so players are coming out of this severely damaged. And I think this is where a lot of the tension has been. I think it's a really complicated issue from an entertainment perspective, from a responsibility perspective for the corporation, the NFL, and for us, right? There's a reason the NFL is a $10 billion industry. You know, more than 100 million people watch the Super Bowl. So there's a reason for that. And I think one of the things that's happened because of this issue is that it's caused a great deal of introspection about sort of what is it that we're actually watching. And then, of course, it's also created, and we can thank the NFL players for this, it's created a really useful national debate around concussions and what do we want for our kids. I'm in a household where we have a child who plays a contact sport. And so that question of how much do we want him exposed to that, you know, has been constant. And of course, we're not alone. That conversation is happening all over the country. Mm. And we can thank the NFL players for that. They have brought that debate to, you know, into our lives.
The stakes here. I think there's a story that really shows how high the stakes were here, and that's the battle over Junior Seau's brain. How did that show you just how willing both sides were to sort of go to the mat?
When Junior Seau shot himself to death, there immediately was a race among neuroscientists to acquire his brain so it could be studied. And I think it really spoke to where we are on this issue now, that in addition to all the attention, the obvious concern for players and what's happening to them, that this has become a hot scientific topic with a lot of research money, prestige, notoriety, and, you know, for the NFL, its future, which I don't think it's an overstatement, at stake.
Steve Vanneroo is a senior writer for ESPN, also the co-author with his brother Mark Vanneroo-Wada of the forthcoming book League of Denial, a frontline documentary with the same name based on his reporting, airs on October 8th. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening as we keep the questions coming about a possible intervention by the U.S. in Syria. Ahmed Daoud joins us now, Takeaway listener in Minneapolis who grew up in Kuwait with his family during the Gulf War back in 1991. After witnessing that war firsthand, his family came to the United States, where he's now a citizen working as a semiconductor engineer in the Minneapolis area. Ahmed Daoud, thank you for speaking with us.
Hi.
What is your principal question about what is being contemplated by the Obama administration and now Congress?
Well, I guess my primary question would be, what is the true extent? I don't think they've elaborated adequately enough about what is the true extent of the intervention that they're planning. I think, you know, they've repeated terms like no boots on the ground and surgical strikes and things of that nature. But I think the concern from the Arab world and that I hear being echoed from friends and family overseas is, you know, is this going to spiral into an Iraq situation? Are we going to have U.S. military presence a year down the line in Syria or even 6 months down the line? Or is this truly going to be a situation like Libya or the first Gulf War where things were executed in a very timely and efficient manner and the U.S. was out very quickly?
Ahmed, some of this came up in the hearings yesterday, and I think we'll probably hear more of it over the next few days. But how many conversations have you had with friends, family, back in the Middle East, people who are from the Middle East who are part of your friend network here in the United States, that go along the lines of, man, we could soon be looking at instability, war, and violence from Libya to Egypt to Syria to Lebanon straight through to the Gulf and Bahrain, including maybe even Kuwait. Had any conversations like that?
I have. And the interesting thing is the concern seems to be more about what is the extent of a U.S. intervention going to be rather than the necessity of that right now, which I think from being able to take a step back and look at things from a somewhat aerial perspective, having both perspectives, being a U.S. citizen, being living here in the U.S. and also having strong roots back there and family back there, I think my concern is more, you know, we need some sort of U.S. intervention and we need it yesterday because every minute that passes, the people over there don't have the luxury of the time that we have here to contemplate it and weigh things through Congress. There is definitely, like you said, the concern that things would spill over if the situation is not managed, and that's a very true threat, and it could destabilize the entire region. People are worried about that. People are concerned about that. But also people have some sort of a knee-jerk aversion to the idea of a U.S. intervention because, you know, they're still traumatized with the experience with a very strong military presence still to this day in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and it doesn't seem to be going away as quickly as people had hoped.
So I'm hearing an odd parallel. Earlier on the program, an Israeli official suggested that there's a lot of sense within Israel of a feeling of caution. Whoa, careful. This could go wrong. That's echoed in the Arab world, it sounds like.
Absolutely. People do acknowledge that this is a powder keg. A lot of people in Arab nations, I have friends in Egypt and in Syria and in Jordan, and their concern is this is spilling over to other countries. These conflicts, people from both sides of the conflicts, both Alawites and Sunnis, some of them are escaping Syria, and these conflicts could spill over to being localized conflicts in the countries to which they are going to seek refuge in. And so it could quickly spiral into small pockets of conflict in many of the surrounding countries.
Well, Ahmed Dawood, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ahmed Dawood is a semiconductor engineer who works just outside Minneapolis. He was a child living in Kuwait with his family during the Gulf War in 1991. He's a U.S. citizen today. The leader of Russia was not at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing yesterday, but Vladimir Putin certainly had some testimony to deliver.
In line with international law, only the UN Security Council can sanction the use of force against a sovereign state. Any other pretext or method which might be used to justify the use of force against an independent sovereign state is inadmissible and can only be interpreted as aggression.
Vladimir Putin there speaking to the Associated Press and Russia's state Channel 1 television. Putin's comments come in advance of a G20 summit, which starts in St. Petersburg tomorrow. Joining us from Moscow is David Herzenhorn, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. David, welcome.
Great to be with you.
Is Vladimir Putin injecting himself into this debate or setting the stage for the summit in St. Petersburg?
Both. Of course, Vladimir Putin and Russia have been at the center of this disagreement over what to do in Syria for quite some time. And there's no question that the political difficulties that President Obama seems to have faced in recent days have actually played very well for Russia's position. Putin has opposed military intervention in Syria. He says he remains unconvinced by the evidence put forward by Secretary of State John Kerry and others. Says we don't know if there were chemical weapons used or if they were some kind of chemical pollutant. In the meantime, he's presenting himself as a defender of international law, that the U.S. has to get authorization from the United Nations Security Council before any military strike, and that anything else, he said, would really be a sign of aggression and a violation of the law.
Any reaction to John Kerry's remarks yesterday before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where he described Russia's relationship with Syria in terms that I didn't quite understand? Perhaps they're meaningful to Vladimir Putin. He said the relationship was transactional, that there's no real stake in responding militarily by Russia as far as Syria is concerned. This is bluster and nothing more.
Well, that's a real oversimplification, and we've described this relationship in quite a bit of detail in our pages in the New York Times. There's certainly some transactions that take place in terms of military sales by Russia to the Assad regime, and Mr. Putin in his interview with the AP was clear that those sales are legal, they have continued and will continue. But in fact, there's a lot more going on between these two countries. Many people know that Russia has a small naval installation at Tartus in Syria. There are also many Syrians that have come to Russia for university and for graduate studies, many Syrians who marry Russian women and take them back to Syria with them. There's a big Syrian community here in Moscow. And so these ties, not to mention ties between the Orthodox Christian churches in Russia and in Syria, are quite a bit deeper than I think what the Secretary of State was suggesting there. And putting that aside, Putin is trying to make this point that really goes to him not wanting the United States seen as the sole decider and setter of the international agenda. And so to the extent that this conversation is happening at all, what should be done and who gets to decide? Does the Security Council back any action that the United States takes, even if Congress has authorized it? All of this really plays much more into Putin's view of the world, which is that, in fact, it's a bigger conversation that should include Russia and China. France, certainly, he was smiling when the British Parliament voted against intervening and saw a split between the United States and its closest ally.
And there's a smaller conversation as well with oil prices up around $110 a barrel. All this really benefits Putin just in pure cash terms.
Well, there's no question. Russia is a huge oil producer. A lot of its economy is dependent on oil and gas. And as long as prices stay high, that's good for Russia. Of course, there's always the risk that if there is conflict, there are worries about shortages, that there are other things that could go wrong and that may change that calculation. But for the moment, you're right. There is nothing bad in this for Russia as far as we can see at this moment.
David Herzenhorn, reporter for our partner, The New York Times, reporting from Moscow. Thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
Listen now to the radical words of this author, academic, professor, talking about how the U.S. didn't intervene in the genocide in Rwanda.
It's almost as though the worse the crime, the more likely we are to say, oh, like, who can even begin to go there and begin to think about making a difference when you have, you know, 8,000 people being murdered a day and bodies, like, piling up.
That is the voice of Samantha Power, one-time humanitarian gadfly, academic outsider, and savage critic of U.S. foreign policy, who today is President Obama's ambassador to the United Nations. Listen now to the radical words of a one-time patient talking about what goes on inside her abnormal head.
The way I think is completely different. I used to think everybody thought in photorealistic pictures. Like if you say to me, think about a church steeple, I only see specific ones. I thought everybody thought that way.
Temple Grandin, once dismissed as mentally retarded, then diagnosed as autistic, she is now one of the radical advocates and authorities on autism as a window on how the brain works. Her writings and ideas have challenged our whole idea of normal. From the fringe to the mainstream, such stories revolve around fascinating characters, but they also tell us a lot about our society and how it defines the outsider. Alyssa Quart's new book, Republic of Outsiders, The Power of Amateurs, Rebels, and Dreamers, is a romp through the renegade nation, once fringy people who have changed the world.
Well, what often happens is that a bit of somebody's idea gets kind of scraped off, and the most assimilatable elements of a given movement or a given style gets taken by the mainstream, and then the people who actually created it to begin with are still left behind. So it's often a complicated process. I interviewed animal rights activists, for instance, and the most extreme or the most challenging of the animal rights activists were not the ones whose ideas were necessarily being absorbed by the mainstream. It was the ones that Whole Foods could sell on its meat aisles that were, you know, readily assimilated.
Being an outsider in America today is a completely mainstream position. Nobody admits to being an insider, right?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I remember it's probably not just now. There's an interview with Joan Didion, the author who is the ultimate insider, saying something like, I always felt like an outsider.
No, everyone says that. In a sense, everybody wants to be a renegade who have, you know, whose opinions were disputed in the beginning and then were vindicated by events, and they sort of take over and triumph. What is it about these outsiders that makes them really outsiders?
Well, it's interesting because I actually put all my sources to an outsider test, whether they could remain outside for more than a year or two. And it wasn't always that easy because how quickly culture works now. The ones that did last as outsiders had some elements that were harder to assimilate into mainstream culture than others, had challenging ideas or practices that just would always be on the outer limits of aesthetics, politics, what have you.
But the characters in your book seem to distinguish themselves by having, and David Lee is an example of this, their sort of alternative view is informed by a passionate moment, a revelatory moment.
Yeah, I kept trying to look for these moments because I felt even in my own life I had had them. And I knew that, for instance, in David Lee's case, he sells meat made from grain, and he really wanted to sell vegan meat that people wouldn't ever, you know, say, gosh, I don't want to eat this. It tastes like the film Solly and Green, you know. No, I want to eat this. It, you know, actually tastes like meat. And so he set out to do that after he saw some chickens dying at a chicken slaughterhouse in Seattle. And once he saw those chickens, he just had been a chef before and said, you know, I'm going to be a vegetarian, or, you know, I'm going to eat fish, but I'm not going to eat meat. And I'm going to really spend the rest of my life thinking how I'm going to make other people also want to eat vegetables, not meat.
I mean, his sense of the conditions that thousands and thousands of people work in for chickens motivated him to this cause that has transformed food.
Yeah, and it's a cause that, you know, David Lee, again, you know, when I started interviewing him in 2008 or I think even 2007, that this was far out to start making meat that artificial meat through gluten that tasted like actual meat. And now it's like a huge thing. There's this company called Beyond Meat. Venture capitalists are investing in it. So even in the course of my reporting, which was 5 years, his particular strand of outsiderism has been absorbed.
Do you find that naivete about conventional wisdom or total ignorance of conventional wisdom produces more creativity than anger and distrust and suspicion of conventional wisdom?
I'm not sure. I think that distrust is a motivator. And especially now, you see a lot of social services and everything from, you know, mental health services to conventional kind of corporate culture, like music labels, faltering and fragmenting. So you see just a lot of spaces for people to feel like they're not being taken care of and there aren't the traditional goals to obtain. So I don't know if that's distrust or if it's just, wow, I'm alone here. I'm going to have to make a different way into the world.
Who is it that you like more, the personalities of the fighters who just never give up or the ones who kind of confusedly stumble into a brave new world and just are too ignorant enough to not stop?
Well, that's such a loaded question because obviously I like the fighters better. I mean, you know, I'm a writer. You know, I like people who are highly subjective and are going at things through, you know, the beat of their own drummer in a very pointed way. I mean, the naive outsider artist is interesting, but their lack of awareness, the fact that they're not really running on a philosophy is not as interesting to me. I mean, I think one of the things that unites all the people in my book is they live philosophy. They live an idea.
So are you a fighter? Are you an outsider?
Well, you know, I think I'm both. And like, I think most people who sort of function as well as, I don't know if I function so well, but as well as many people in media have to, are both outsiders and insiders, right? I mean, I'm an outsider in the sense that I grew up on the edges of a counterculture in the East Village in Manhattan. And my parents weren't outsiders, but I'd say they were connoisseurs of outsiders. And
how did that work? That sounds like some interesting Friday night party.
Well, it meant we watched a lot of avant-garde cinema in sort of people's lofts in Soho and so forth. And then, you know, I'm an insider in the sense, yeah, I went to journalism school. I wrote for mainstream publications. I wrote for mainstream presses, publishers. And at one point, I realized probably around 2007, gosh, you know, there's all these bloggers out there. You know, the word rate is going down. And I'm an insider now of a certain kind who's being besieged by outsiders.
Final question. Why are there so few real outsiders of the kind in this book in American politics?
I mean, I think you can see the process that these people have to go through, A, to find themselves, to become themselves, to stay the course, the level of, you know, poverty they're sometimes experiencing and humiliation. There's a animal rights lawyer who people barked at him when he started entering courtrooms. I mean, do you imagine any politician who had this level of commitment, what would happen to them and the strangeness? You know, it would not be a pleasant journey.
Alyssa Court, thanks so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Alyssa Court is the author of Republic of Outsiders, The Power of Amateurs, Rebels, and Dreamers.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.
The entire debate over intervention in Syria hinges on a notion of international norms and some self-evident morality regarding the use of chemical weapons. A morality espoused yesterday by Secretary of State John Kerry speaking before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
This debate is about the world's red line. It's about humanity's red line. And it's a red line that anyone with a conscience ought to draw.
Although one is compelled to ask, where were the consciences drawing those same lines when these weapons were first invented, created, and tested? Surely one doesn't need physical confirmation that a weapon that kills people by the tens of thousands, that clears cities of populations by causing quick and painful deaths, would raise a few moral problems. The irony is that the category of weapons called WMD were all devised with some moral notion in mind. Nuclear bombs were used on Japan, we were told, to prevent the greater loss of life that would have come from a full-scale invasion. Chemical and biological weapons were devised to eliminate whole armies while leaving the cities they were defending intact. The neutron bomb of the 1980s was a nuclear version of such a weapon, small blast but high doses of radiation. It would kill people while leaving buildings standing. Here's the inventor of the neutron bomb, physicist Sam Cohen, in an interview just before he died in 2010.
Real early on, I began to see radiation, nuclear radiation, as an effective means of waging ground warfare in a relatively moral way. It's not about logic, and it's not about rationality. It's not even about sanity.
Insane, perhaps, because the temptation to use such weapons like neutron bombs, chemical warfare agents, on large civilian populations is just too great, hence the atrocity in Syria. Joining us now is Joseph Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation. Joe, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
It's almost a demented logic that created these weapons and then causes them to be used against civilian populations, since that was never the original rationale.
Yeah, these weapons were designed to try to take out large numbers of troops. So chemical weapons, for example, were introduced in World War II, where they worked in trench warfare. These are heavier than air weapons, so clouds of poisonous gas would spread across the battlefield, descend down into the trenches. But they only work that well when you have these mass concentrations of populations, either civilian or military. They don't work very well in modern mechanized, rapidly moving warfare, which is why you saw chemical weapons being abandoned by most militaries around the world.
So they have a utility in clearing populations of cities. The neutron bomb was invented long after we understood that chemical agents weren't terribly useful in World War One.
Yeah, the neutron bomb, some people called that the capitalist bomb. It would kill people but leave buildings standing. The idea behind both biological and chemical weapons was both mass killing and that it would have a terror aspect. I mean, just the idea of poisons or viruses, things you can't see or smell or touch but could still kill you, spreads terror throughout the population. It's one of the reasons that we have the prohibition against these weapons. As Secretary Hagel said yesterday in Senate testimony, the chemical weapons are an assault on humanity. There are very few countries in the world that still have either biological or chemical weapons.
You are a member of Secretary of State John Kerry's International Security Advisory Board, and you advise him on matters like this. Is it your impression that we've reached some point in humanity where these weapons are not even on the drawing board anymore? Or is it possible that there are still weapons designers out there somewhere looking at ways of depopulating entire cities in some future scenario of war using nuclear, chemical, or biological agents?
There's probably some scientists still working on things like recombinant DNA and using that to explore the possibility of a new biological agent. But it's nothing like what we went through in the middle of the 20th century. You have to remember that the United States used to have the largest and most effective stockpile of biological weapons ever invented. We had enough toxins and viruses to kill every man, woman, and child on the planet. We gave them up voluntarily, unilaterally. President Nixon decided in the late 1960s that we shouldn't have these biological weapons. In fact, that nobody should have them. And he organized what's called the Biological Weapons Convention, banning it. We gave up our stockpiles. Almost all countries in the world did. The same happened with chemicals. We are destroying the 30,000 tons of these things we built during the Cold War. The Russians are destroying the 40,000 tons they built. You're really down to a handful of nations, maybe some isolated scientists still working on this, but it's the exception, whereas it used to be the norm for major powers.
We're talking with Joseph Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund. Joe, you know, I remember the famous scene from the movie Dr. Strangelove, where there was a crazed scientist based on certain true characters, I won't go into them now, who described a kind of strategic utility in striking first, in wiping them out using conventional nuclear weapons. I say conventional, but they were talking nuclear weapons. Is there a Strangelovian kind of scenario that you've ever heard of in the government involving biological, chemical agents, neutron bombs, even outside of the United States?
Well, there are really gradations of this. They're all lumped into this category of weapons of mass destruction, but it's a little misleading. Chemical weapons can kill thousands, even tens of thousands, but it requires massive amounts of that, of those weapons, hundreds of planes, for example, to do a mass strike. Biological, a step up, but still very difficult to deliver. It's hard to have a biological weapon really kill thousands or even tens of thousands of people. Nuclear weapons are really in a class by themselves. One bomb, one city wiped out.
Finally, as we contemplate much of this century in front of us, in the middle of this Syrian crisis now being debated on Capitol Hill, is it your view and the view of Plowshares Fund that sometime in this century humanity will cross one of these red lines?
Well, that's the risk. I think as we reduce our chemical and biological stockpiles down to just handfuls of these weapons held by a few countries, the risk that those will be used is decreasing. And part of the Syrian conflict is all about getting those last holdouts to give up these weapons. But nuclear weapons, you know, one mistake, you can lose a city. So until we get down to very low numbers of nuclear weapons, there is continues to be a danger that these weapons can be used. Historically, the global trends are away from these weapons, fewer of these weapons, fewer countries with these weapons. I actually think that during this century, we're going to see the end completely of chemical and biological weapons, and over the next few decades, see nuclear weapons go down to just a handful and eventually zero.
There's a positive note. Joseph Cirincione, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, John.
Joseph Cirincione is president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation. We're continuing to follow the debate over U.S. intervention in Syria all this week. We're hearing from you.
My name is Haya Ajan from Charlotte, North Carolina. I am supporting the strike on Syria. I think we need to get Assad. He's a dictator. He is like Hitler. He's killing the children. And we really need to do something to stop him. It's our obligation, I feel, as a human being to support other human beings that are weak and need help.
We always want to hear from you, of course. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tweet us your questions at The Takeaway or weigh in at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening and joining this national debate. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.